This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
96 degrees in the shade.
Yes, the hot summer is coming to the Northern Hemisphere. If you are in the American South or California, it's been toasty for some months already. The future looks hotter still, as our emissions cause the climate system to swing towards its greenhouse state. Farms will be in trouble, and so will your own home garden. Later in this program, I'll continue with our series on growing in the heat. We'll hear great tips from experts in Florida and Colorado, ideas I'm already applying in my own garden. I also have two interviews for you. Pretty well every aspect of our problems and the solutions involve the flow of big money. Many of us are unwilling partners in the malinvestment in corporations profiting from damaging the environment. It could be pensions, investments, or just your savings in the bank. Where is it going? We'll talk with a heavyweight New York investment advisor about the realities of socially responsible investing. But first, I want to get back to one of the few natural big-scale possibilities to save ourselves from the worst of climate change. It is not glamorous. It's just really, really important. I keep listening for more soil carbon news. It's not big on CNN or YouTube, but it could be big news for the future. And that's why I was pleased to find Courtney White has tied a lot of on-the-ground experience together for his new book, Grass, Soil, Hope. In a foreword, Michael Pollan wrote, "This book promises to stir up hope even among those made cynical by relentless bad news." Courtney White takes us on a journey through carbon country. Courtney, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you very much. I'm glad, happy to be here.
Well, let's start with a bit of an introduction of you for our listeners. Where is your home region, and are you affiliated with an organization?
Yeah, you bet. I live in Santa Fe, New Mexico. I'm from Phoenix, Arizona, and as I say in the book, that my background is in conservation. I was an activist with the Sierra Club for many years here in New Mexico, but I grew up as a boy in the suburbs of Phoenix, not thinking about kind of any of these issues. Soil carbon, the least of them, and my journey kind of wound around, and my wife and I moved to New Mexico, and I got involved with the Sierra Club. And I met a rancher in 1997 who was doing things differently on his ranch here. And he and I started talking about all the kind of fights between ranchers and environmentalists going on at the time and conservation activities and the way he ranched. He ranched differently. He moved his cows around differently. And we decided to start a little nonprofit in 1998 called the Kivira Coalition as a way to kind of bring some peace and find some common ground between conservationists and ranchers and scientists and other folks. We founded it, and I've directed it for 16 years. I turned the reins over to a young woman, Avery Anderson, here. She's doing a great job, and I set off to write books and follow carbon, follow the carbon trail, which led to the book.
We've had Alan Savory as a guest on Radio EcoShock. He pioneered the use of carefully controlled cattle herds to replenish carbon in the soil. What do you think of his work and technique?
Oh, yeah, we're big fans. Jim Winder, the rancher, was an early practitioner of Alan Savory's ideas. We know many ranchers across the West who practice, you know, some form or some variation on Alan's ideas. We as an organization kind of took it kind of a different direction, maybe up a level, and trying to tie progressive cattle management into kind of larger issues to do with local food production, grass-fed food. We ran a ranch for a while ourselves, trying to do conservation work. We've done a lot of ecological restoration in creeks, rethinking the way erosion happens and the roads on the land. So we kind of folded it all together, but kind of at heart were the principles Alan Savory pioneered, kind of using nature's original ideas, in this case, how herbivores move and graze across landscapes. And we kind of taken all that basic idea of nature knows best, needs some help from us, because we have some technology and other things. And that applies certainly to carbon in the soils. As I learned one day when I read a publication about how to build soil carbon through above ground management. And that's what kind of set me off on this journey through carbon country, as I call it.
So who are some of the other people who do say that building up soil carbon may be the best large-scale solution for dangerous greenhouse gas emissions?
Yeah, and so when I first heard about this, I did some research. I found a couple of people right away. The most prominent is a professor named Ratan Lal, who's at, I believe, Iowa State. He's a soil scientist, and he's the one that kind of floated the idea years ago that if you increased the carbon content of soil, and that if anybody who's a listener is a gardener, you know what that is. It's the tilth, it's the carbon in the soils is what makes soil dark and rich and productive. He said through photosynthesis, through carbon dioxide being pulled down through plants into soils, through roots, if you could increase that carbon content somehow, he did the math real quick and said it has the potential to pull a lot of carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere and store it in the soils. And what's important is that the plants, through the sort of natural processes, will respire or breathe out carbon dioxide from the soil, microbes and all that kind of stuff. But if you can store more than comes back out, then you got a net positive. And so he started that ball rolling. And then there's a soil scientist in Australia, Dr. Christine Jones, who did a lot of kind of on-the-ground research, measuring soil carbon, looking at ranch management, farm management, said this is a great idea. She has a website called amazingcarbon.com. And from there, a whole bunch of folks kind of pick up the idea. Darren Doherty, who's a permacultural expert in Australia, there's a group of northeastern farmers that started the Soil Carbon Farmers of America. It kind of snowballed quickly. We did a conference on it in 2010 called the Carbon Ranch. I tried to pull all these folks together, so we had Christine Jones and other folks come and speak about the potential for sequestering carbon dioxide in soils. And I got all excited by this, and I decided to take the idea and run with it. Ended up interviewing a lot of these folks for the book, and it's hopeful. It's not the answer to the larger problems, but it's certainly one key part of the climate puzzle is how to pull CO2 naturally out of the sky and store it in soils. So we can do it. We don't need fancy technology. All we need is plants, photosynthesis, sunlight, water, and animals.
You know, I like the sound of that a lot better than geoengineering, you know, where we toss some chemicals into the sky and hope that makes up for our carbon sins. So where did you go? Who are the voices in your new book, Grass, Soil, Hope?
Well, I traveled across the country and also to Australia. There's actually quite a bit going on in Australia, both on the land management side and on the kind of policy side of things, at least until they had a change in government last fall where it was a big setback on a lot of fronts. But in California, there's a lot going on. I started with the Marin Carbon Project, which was a small ranch in Marin County that decided to scientifically measure carbon in soils, involving scientists at UC Berkeley doing some really interesting work. So from there, I went to a farm in New Hampshire, a young farmer named Doran Cox, who calls himself a carbon farmer, and what he's doing on his organic farm, biodiesel, organic, no-till farming. And then I went to Kansas and looked at cover crops. I went to New Orleans and Louisiana to look at wetlands restoration and what's called blue carbon, how to store CO2 in mangrove swamps and wetlands of the south. And I went to Australia to look at a bunch of new ideas in farm management and ranch management down there. I have a whole chapter on ecological restoration in creeks, which is a great place to store carbon in creek banks. I have a little profile of beavers. Beavers are nature's original carbon engineers. What beaver ponds can do, storing carbon in those soils of beaver ponds, peats and bogs and things like that, is huge. I mean, it's just giant. Unfortunately, we did a number on the beaver populations in North America, but they're coming back, and beaver are our friends, and they'll do all this work for free, which is what's great. Yeah, I'm with you. The geoengineering side of this is nutty. It's absolutely not guaranteed to work, necessarily. However, we have photosynthesis, and it's only been going on Earth for about, 2 billion years? let's use these natural principles that we know that work and have benefits for everybody, food, animals, plants. Let's work on that side of it first before we start getting into high-tech adventuring.
I did not know that about the beaver. That's Canada's national animal, and now we have another reason why it should be so. This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with Courtney White, author of an important new book, Grass, Soil, Hope, A Journey Through Carbon Country, and this may be the best way to combat climate change. Courtney, let's get down to it. How much carbon can be restored to the soil? Is it really such a big deal?
I don't have the numbers off the top of my head. They've kind of, different folks have different numbers, but they're large numbers. I mean, the amount of CO2 that can be pulled down through photosynthesis into the soils. I've seen in California, for example, numbers that say you could offset all the transportation sector of California over a period of time by successfully sequestering carbon in soils. It's a little bit of a challenge on the management side, just to be honest with you. You've got to have rain. You've got to have plants growing, putting down deeper roots. If there's a drought on, this whole thing slows down quite a lot. It's all key to the what's called the carbon cycle. Earth is a giant carbon laundry machine, carbon out of the atmosphere through plants into soils. Eventually, they come out of soils back into the atmosphere. This has been going on for a long time. By increasing the amount of plants that can pull down CO2 and deeper roots, we can actually suck up a fair amount of CO2. So the numbers are big. There's a lot of rangelands across the planet. It's the largest terrestrial ecosystem is rangelands. And if you can improve the carbon content or by 1 to 2% only, you know, from say 2% carbon to 4% carbon, as has happened, the numbers attached to that are large, and it's exciting. I need to add one quick caveat though, because it's important. This is not the be-all and end-all of the climate challenge. We still have to cut greenhouse gas emissions on the front end of this. If they keep rising, this all gets harder for us. But what's neat about carbon in soils is that it's a way of mitigating on the other side of this. So we cut greenhouse gas emissions that are going up, and plants are a great way to pull that excess CO2 that's up there already down. And Dr. Jim Hansen, leading climatologist in the country, wrote back in 2009 that if we could do two things to help the climate crisis, one is to cut coal use to zero, and the other would be to rehab agricultural and forestry practices to soak up all that extra CO2. So I'm hopeful.
Well, you know, that's part of the problem. This can go the other way. We've been losing carbon from the soils for generations, and it seems like modern agribusiness is still really a source of carbon emissions rather than a helpful sink. If we do it wrong, it can go wrong.
Yes, no, I totally agree with you, and I want to emphasize to your listeners that we're not talking about industrial agriculture. We're talking about organic, regenerative, biological agriculture. Now, it's not obviously happening on the scale that we'd all like, but Rodale Institute in Pennsylvania has done the math on what organic can do for these systems. It's all good, but yes, at the same time, we have this large industrial food system that's producing a lot of greenhouse gas emissions. And we need to figure that out at some level. But what's nice about, for me, what was neat about this was carbon is generally portrayed as the bad guy, right? Oh, we got too much carbon. We have this war on carbon. We have to cut our carbon. We have to, you know, that kind of stuff. And forgetting that carbon is the element of life. You know, we can't have life without carbon. It's the essential ingredient after oxygen for life on the planet. We're carbon-based life forms, all that, you know, kind of stuff. So the goal is to kind of turn the idea of carbon around to the positive. It's the same substance, but here's a positive way of looking at the situation. And it's not abstract. I mean, these things are happening on the ground in farms and ranches and wetlands, beavers. On a small scale, we need to scale it up, and that's the challenge. But at least we can start that conversation with this book and other books that are coming out about kind of how do we kind of rethink our relationship to carbon.
What would you say is new in your book, Grass, Soil, and Hope, that we may not have heard before?
Well, I think for many listeners, especially folks who live in cities, they don't understand that agriculture done sustainably can be an answer to the problem. We not just a source of climate emissions or greenhouse gas emissions. You know, when I go to conferences, somebody invariably kind of stands up and says, "What's the one thing I can do for the planet?" And almost always somebody says, "Well, stop eating red meat, you know, or reduce your carbon footprint through your food use." And kind of lost in that is that, and generally you get this kind of negative image about our food system, when in fact there are positive elements to it. In fact, they can be part of the answer here if we know where to look, especially where to buy and where to eat. So I say to folks, it's not just red meat, it's where that red meat is from. Is it from a sustainable ranch or farm? Is it from a carbon farm or a carbon ranch where someone's, you know, intentionally trying to do the right things here? And I would sort of challenge listeners to think about where their food comes from in a carbon context. And so this is new. This is on top of organic. This is on top of grass-fed, kind of on top of all those things. It's now to think about the carbon element in food production. So, and it's more than that. You know, there's a lot of restoration activities. You said earlier that we've depleted a lot of carbon from our soils, and that's absolutely true through some bad land management over the decades. However, this is what's new, is that depletion is now an opportunity. So these soils have been depleted of carbon, and they're sitting there ready to soak up more carbon, given the right management, meaning they depleted, let's say, from 8% soil carbon down to 2%. In Australia, it's down to 1.5%. What if we turned it around and filled it back up to, you know, 6, 7, 8% again? And they've done the math on that, and that's a huge amount of CO2, potentially, if we can change our management. So that's new. So that's all these problems become opportunities if we simply change our thinking, first and foremost.
You know, you told us you were a Sierra Club activist, and now you seem to call that the conflict industry. Can you explain that?
Well, yes. When I was in the Sierra Club, and I met some wonderful people, we did a lot of good work, but there was generally a fight-em kind of mindset, you know, fight the mining industry, fight the cattle, you know, kind of fight, fight, fight. The environmental movement was missing these kind of common ground opportunities, practices, that achieved conservation goals as well as food production goals. They were just kind of leaped over in this kind of fight, fight, fight mentality of the 1990s. And when I met this rancher who was doing conservation work, and he liked wildlife and was putting water back in his creeks and producing food, I saw, okay, here is a win-win for us all. But I meant leaving that kind of conflict industry behind, where folks just kind of benefit from endless brawling, and try peacemaking, common ground kinds of things, again, kind of turning those negatives into positives the way that he did. It's worked. I mean, there's a lot less fighting and brawling between ranchers and environmentalists today. A lot of folks understand the value of working landscapes today, local food, grass-fed food, organic food produced by farmers and ranchers, protecting open space, all those kind of cool things. Now we add carbon on top of it. We got a pretty exciting equation. It means that the environmental movement has had to give up some cherished beliefs and kind of move along. Some folks haven't, some have. Same goes for the ranching industry. They've had to give up some things. And we're all trying to move forward together in these challenging times. And I'm seeing good progress, and I feel hopeful.
What could different levels of government do to help the process of capturing carbon back into the soil?
Yeah, this is kind of the $64,000 question. How do you turn this these great ideas, practices, into policy? And that's not clear yet. We need to find a way to incentivize carbon storage in soils, and that's going to need some kind of economic incentive. It'd be nice if the government would incentivize carbon storage. The quick answer to your question is, to be honest with you, a carbon tax. A carbon tax would reduce emissions on the front end. It would create a pool of money to pay folks potentially to sequester carbon in soils. I know the word tax is a dirty word these days. However, I think sooner or later we're going to have to do something on the front end of this to deal with greenhouse gas emissions. And if you create this pool of money and pay folks somehow for sustainable practices in soils, you know, whether it's a direct payment or an added value payment of some sort, here's a win-win for the climate. And I know it's politically unfeasible today, but I'm hopeful that somewhere down the line, that policy side of it, that piece of it comes together and we can do something for all of us.
You know, I've been wondering, Courtney White, if there's a way to make soil carbon sexy so it can spread among young people the way it needs to. I mean, maybe Kim Kardashian could visit a farm and get her hands dirty or something. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, you know, this is the other challenge. It's not sexy. It's soil. It's, you know, it's dirt, you know, and it's hard to kind of give it a public face. That's what I try to do in the book. I try to tell a compelling story about all these folks doing cool stuff. Yeah, how do you capture the public's attention? How do you, that's kind of what we're all sort of struggling with now. It's easy to demonize and make negative images of things. Folks get excited. When you do the positive side of it, it's a little bit harder story to tell. And we haven't quite figured that out yet. I don't think Kim Kardashian is going to visit a farm anytime soon. I hope maybe she will. I don't know. How do you get the media interested? All I can think of, to be honest with you, is in the background is the kind of growing crisis that we all feel. At some point, that just has to kind of translate into action. And then what are the responses? Well, look, hey, all these neat farmers and ranchers, young people. I tell you right now, the young folks I know, and we run an apprenticeship program here at our organization, get it. You know, they get organic. They get local food systems. They're well educated. They have a lot of technology at their fingertips. The carbon thing is kind of coming on. They understand it. Doran Cox is a young farmer. He's chapter two of the book, and he uses the internet and the computing power to measure the carbon in his soils. And you know, he's trying to sell it as a added value to his products. I mean, it's all these pieces are there. All the elements are kind of in place. Young people are interested in this. We just need to figure out how to make it work economically. And, you know, you're not going to get wealthy on soil carbon. You're not going to be Donald Trump of soil carbon. So we have to kind of get past that. But you certainly can be rich in other ways by following these kinds of models. So,
we've been talking about the battle to change our social game plan to put carbon back into the biggest bank, the soil. The problem and the solution are illustrated, as you've heard, with real lives in the new book, Grass, Soil, Hope, A Journey Through Carbon Country. We've been talking with the author, Courtney White. Find links to all this in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.info. Thanks for joining us, Courtney, and I appreciate you getting the book out there.
I appreciate your interest in it, and thank you very much for your time.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org. Here on Radio EcoShock, we normally interview scientists, authors, and activists, but behind almost every problem and solution we encounter, there is a flow of big money. After the financial crash and admissions of guilt by major institutions that we trusted, many of us are suspicious of investing. Big money is being channeled into projects that actually wreck the world, we think. Is socially responsible investing possible? Now, whether you have money to invest or not, the answer to that question could literally determine your future and maybe the fate of our civilization. We can pretend that the world of high finance is too dirty or will fall any day, but instead, I've called up Lewis Berger, the principal and co-founder of Washington Square Capital in New York. Berger was big in the financial end of Hollywood before becoming an advisor for the Swiss bank UBS. He then co-founded his own investment firm. Lewis Berger, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks for having me, Alex.
Well, let's start with this strange question. Why did you agree to talk with me?
Well, I think it's important for a lot of investors and non-investors to understand the importance of socially responsible investing. You know, there's a bit of a growing, I guess, trend towards socially responsible investing, but there's still a lot of people out there that aren't familiar with it and don't either have a firm understanding or want to understand the impact of your investments have on the environment and issues that may be of importance.
So how would we define what socially responsible investing is?
It's really just a means of expressing your values through your investments. And it's kind of a wide umbrella. So, you know, what social responsibility is can mean different things to different people. We tend to focus more on the environmental and humanitarian end of socially responsible investing. But essentially, it's basically looking past the traditional criteria of investing and including social and environmental criteria. So only, say, investing in certain types of companies that meet your criteria and avoiding those companies that don't meet your criteria.
Do you think that does relate to the movements asking about where our food and energy comes from?
Absolutely, yeah. I think there's a direct link there. Socially responsible investing can actually be traced back, at least in the United States, back to the Quakers in the 1800s, where they didn't want to invest in the slave trade. So any sort of business venture that had exposure to slave trade, they didn't want to invest in. And it's actually grown considerably in recent years. Where I see it, and I think the general consensus sees it, is that it is part of this movement that we've seen where people start questioning where their food comes from, where their goods are manufactured and made, how they're made, where their energy comes from. And I think it's a natural extension to start thinking about, okay, I'm changing my consumer habits, but what about my investment dollars? What types of companies are my dollars supporting, and actually making those changes as you see fit?
I hang around the Zero Hedge website and with peak oil people and a crowd with a sort of bleak view of our prospects. Are you optimistic or pessimistic about the economy?
Well, I think in general, you know, the economy has improved in recent years since the credit crisis. We've seen some stronger data in housing and unemployment and a few other metrics. Perhaps my biggest concern, and, you know, you may see this more on the sites of, you know, websites like Zero Hedge, is the Federal Reserve policy in the U.S., their monetary policy over the past few years, which has been supporting and actually providing a bit of a crutch for the economy. So while the data has been pretty good recently and it looks like it'll continue to improve, I think my concern is what happens when the Fed starts unwinding their monetary policy and we see a lot of stimulus they put into place is removed from the market. You know, when you look at the stock and bond market, and the overall economy as a whole, in the United States at least, you know, you'll see a bit of a disconnect. Stock markets are reaching all-time highs daily, and yet the overall economy is still quite sluggish. So there's definitely, I think, a connection that can be made to the policies put in place by the Federal Reserve and the stock market being priced where it is. Now, I don't think you can necessarily put that all at the feet of the Federal Reserve. Congress has been quite inactive in recent years. If you look at the legislation that's been passed in Washington, D.C., it's been quite anemic the past, I think, 2 or 3 years. You know, the concern has been it's been a lack of political will to put any sort of stimulus projects in place that would boost the economy. So, in effect, what that means is it falls into the hands of the Fed to try to stimulate the economy. And they have tools to do that, but the concern is asset prices have grown to the point where we may be seeing some asset bubbles. So to answer your question, I think there is some sense of optimism for the economy as a whole. We just have to be a bit concerned with the stock market, the bond market, how asset prices have been moved by quantitative easing and the Fed's zero interest rate policy.
Yeah, you know, pretty well every day I look to see whether these record highs in the stock market have plunged, and I know I'm not alone in that. I want to ask you, what do you think of the divestment campaigns going on in universities and churches to get out of fossil fuels?
I think it's very encouraging. You're having institutions now starting to question and think about and take responsibility for where their endowments and investment dollars go. And it started from students and faculty coming together and, you know, having awareness and taking responsibility and pushing the administrations of these universities in that direction. So larger institutions generally are slow to make major changes like this, but seeing, you know, Stanford come out and other major universities come out and, you know, announcing their divestment goals, it's very encouraging, and I guess the hope is that this is something, a trend that's going to continue and something we can expect more of in the future.
A large number of environment groups are saying to executives of fossil fuel companies, if you fund junk science and climate denial, then we're going to hold you responsible for climate damages. What is your take on that?
I think it's an interesting idea. I just don't know how realistic it could be, at least in the United States. There would have to be some sort of legislation passed in Congress or at the state level. And I don't see that happening given the current climate in Washington, D.C. You know, you have a large faction of the Republican Party that doesn't, you know, subscribe to the idea of climate change. And then there are moderate Democrats that may not be as strongly on board. So the idea that this type of legislation would be passed and then corporate executives would be held accountable, I think, in the current climate, isn't likely. You know, things could change in the next few years, and this type of legislation could be passed, but I don't see it taking hold in the near term.
Okay, well, Lewis Berger, how can the public find out whether a green investment really is green?
Well, Alex, I think there's two ways to do it. The first way would be to hire someone, an investment advisor, that would screen these companies for you. And, you know, there are quite a few investment advisors out there now that specialize in socially responsible investing and will do this. Now, for other investors that want to do it on their own, there are some resources out there they can look to on the web. CSR Hub, I think, is a good resource. Carbon Disclosure Project is another good resource. You know, it provides some metrics around a company's environmental policy and humanitarian policy and can give an investor a sense of how responsible these companies are. For pooled investments like mutual funds or exchange-traded funds, what an investor needs to do is take a closer look at the underlying investments. What we've been seeing is larger companies, mutual fund companies, and banks have recently been issuing these green-type socially responsible investment funds. And while they're marketed to appeal to environmentally conscious people, they may not necessarily invest that way. So, you know, several of these funds that we've encountered will see investments in companies like too big to fail banks, pharmaceuticals, nuclear power, you know, a different type of approach to investing than, say, you know, environmentally conscious person who wants to completely exclude these types of companies. So I would just say take care. If you're going to do this on your own, do your due diligence, do your research. You know, there's a site called Morningstar, which is a good resource. It's free for most general information where you can go on there, look at a mutual fund, get a sense of what their holdings are, or go to the company websites and see what their standards are for investing. It's definitely a trend, and there's certainly going to be companies and funds out there that try to take advantage of the trend and may not necessarily have an investor or socially responsible investor's best interests at heart. So it's important to do your own research or work with someone who can do the research for you.
This is Radio EcoShock. Our guest is Lewis Berger, a top investment advisor and co-founder of Washington Square Capital Management in New York City. Well, even if you go for a green investment, as you point out in your article on Mosaic, it's still possible you could lose your money. Why don't you tell us what Mosaic is and your concerns about it?
Well, Mosaic is actually a very interesting company, and I think they're doing really good work, I'll say, first of all. And what they're trying to do is crowdsource investment into small-scale solar projects. So they're providing a platform for investors to go on to their website and invest in a solar project. And essentially what they're doing is providing a loan to the project, and Mosaic acts as an intermediary. So it's a really good service in the sense that what it's doing is it's providing capital to small-scale solar projects and providing investment opportunities for individual investors who may want to have exposure to a solar project. So that, I think, is great. Now, there's been a lot of great press, and there's been a lot of glossing over of the inherent risks of investing in this type of platform. And, you know, I'll say again, what they're doing is good work. It's just that as an investor, and I think this speaks for all sort of socially responsible investments, an investor has to take a closer look at the risks. You know, as an investor, your time horizon, diversification, there's a lot of different investment strategies and themes that you have to take into consideration before putting your money to work. So with Mosaic, one of the issues is time horizon. What ends up happening is you're going to buy into a solar project. You're going to lend money to a solar project, which is essentially a bond issued by Mosaic over oftentimes several years. So it could be up to 10, 12-year loan. And the issue there is liquidity. So with other types of bonds or mutual funds or stocks, you can often sell the investment if you need access to your principal. With this type of investment, there wouldn't be that liquidity. So essentially, it's what we say to all investors when they consider socially responsible investment, to know what you're getting into, know what your exit strategy is, understand the risks, understand if you have access to your capital if you need it. And if you don't, then you wouldn't want to necessarily put a large amount of money in there. I think my concern is the way it's been marketed is a bit like a CD or a cash equivalent type account where the risks are low. Now, that's not necessarily the case because the investment is backed by the project and also backed by Mosaic, which is a fairly new company. So you can read my article. It's on greentechmedia.com for more information. But I would just say, as with any investment, just know what you're getting yourself into and do your due diligence and just understand the risks involved before putting your money to work.
I have a friend who inherited some money and looked into this, and basically it seemed like the green fund that she was looking into would return 3-5% on her money, but if she wanted to take a higher risk and invest in the fossil fuel industry, she might make 10-12% on her money. So is it possible to get a decent return without investing in something that damages our future?
Absolutely. It depends on what the investment your friend was looking at, but there's no way to guarantee future returns. It's simply not possible. Or it's disingenuous if someone does do that. You can only look at past performance and get a sense of what future returns may be. With fixed income or bonds, you're paid out an interest rate that's fixed, so there's a bit more certainty with what types of returns you can receive, but it's not necessarily guaranteed. I think when looking at the investment universe, companies that take CSR criteria into consideration are going to benefit in the longer term. These are the companies that are forward-looking, that are considering the risks to climate change, that are considering our dwindling fossil fuel resources, that are considering the well-being of their employees, the environment, indigenous cultures around the world that they may be doing business with, and putting all these considerations to work. Those companies, we feel are the ones that are going to prosper in the long term. Companies that are short term and looking from quarter to quarter, maximizing their profits, are going to be caught blindsided when changes happen. So not only do we think that a socially responsible approach to corporate management, to investing, benefits the individual investor from a values perspective, we think it's going to be financially beneficial in the longer term. As these larger companies confront these problems and building contingencies to start dealing with them now rather than waiting for a crisis down the road.
Lewis Berger, I'm sure you're aware there's a growing resentment against too-big-to-fail banks who appear to get away with price-fixing or even fraud with no criminal charges. It's my impression this resentment is spilling over to any investment or anybody in the investment field. Do you worry this kind of disconnect could hurt your industry? And if so, how could that be overcome or ameliorated?
First of all, I'd say that the anger and resentment is absolutely warranted. Look, we've had a crisis that occurred in which the too-big-to-fail banks were largely responsible. There wasn't any sort of comeuppance for these banks. There were some fines, but none of the senior executives went to jail. There's been some legislation put in place, but nothing has really fundamentally changed the way these banks do business. So the mistrust, the resentment, I think, is absolutely justified. Now, looking at the financial services industry as a whole, I think most people can look at what a giant mega bank does, and a firm like ours, we're a small independent company, how we operate is going to be very different. So these larger institutions, I think, have damaged their brands. And unless they clean up their acts, longer term, there's going to be a movement away from either banking or investing or even wanting to work at those types of institutions. So we've actually started to see that within our industry. We started our firm 5 years ago, and we left UBS and opened up our company. And what we've seen is a lot of investment advisors following the same path. And, you know, for several reasons, the largest reason being when you're independent, you're reporting to your clients. That's your first obligation, is to act in the best interest of your clients and to ensure that they're taken care of. At a larger firm, there are tons of conflicts of interest that come up. There's going to be, you know, issues with shareholders, issues with colleagues around the world that are doing illegal activities, you know, potentially. There's issues with, you know, if you look at any of the big banks, there's litigation issues that as an employee, you're technically on the hook for when you're dealing with your clients. So the independent space has been growing quite considerably, and we see that as the trend going forward. So I think the public's going to look at the space and they're going to say, okay, I have the choice between working with a large mega bank that may have been, you know, intimately involved in the credit crisis, continues to have bad behavior. Am I going to want to work with that type of company or a smaller independent company where their interests are aligned with mine? And I think the case, it seems to be evolving that the latter is what most of the public is leaning towards. You know, another thing I think that it's interesting with the financial crisis and what's happening here in the United States is a generational shift. We're seeing the millennial generation now coming of age, and there's money being inherited. They are earning money. You know, they're in the workforce. They've come of age at a time when they've lived through a major, major financial crisis. And they've seen firsthand what the big banks have done. And what oftentimes happens is these millennials are inheriting money. They're inheriting financial advisors that either their parents or their grandparents used. And these financial advisors oftentimes aren't equipped to work with them, either helping them with a socially responsible or sustainable investment portfolio, or just having a sense of an independence or an openness and a willingness to consider other alternatives besides traditional investment strategies.
So shop around if you're looking for an investment advisor and ask some of the questions you've brought up. I think we're going to have to leave it there. We've been talking with Lewis Berger, the principal and co-founder of Washington Square Capital Management in New York City. Lewis, thank you so much for the free advice.
Thank you very much, Alex. It was a pleasure.
I'm Alex Smith, reporting for Radio EcoShock.
96 degrees in the shade.
Radio EcoShock. Last week, we heard Marjorie Wildcraft with tips on gardening in extreme heat. Marjorie will be joining us in a program soon. You may think you will grow some of your own food, but how will you deal with record heat or drought? Even more worrying, as we heard on one of our shows a couple of years ago from YouTube garden guru Humpty Dumpty Tribe, if the nights don't cool down, plants won't set fruit. You can have flowers, busy bees, and still get no tomatoes. That's going to be a problem for most of us in the coming years. Let's start with this recording of a YouTube video from Carol O'Meara, a horticulture expert from Colorado State University. She recorded this essential video during one of Colorado's stunning heat waves.
Hi, I'm Carol O'Meara, horticulture entomologist with Colorado State University Extension here in Boulder County. Things got awfully hot in a hurry. My husband woke me up this morning to a nice reggae tune called 96 Degrees in the Shade. It's really hot this week, and the plants, the ones that we put in spring, they're beginning to think it's the Armageddon. So let's take a few tips that we can put into the vegetable garden to keep our plants cool and extend that spring spirit out just a little bit longer. Peas are really sensitive to getting hot. And in fact, even though these peas here are just starting to come into their own and starting to climb this fence, this heat is going to change them and they're going to start burning out before we get good production. One of the things that we can do, and it's a nice secret that a lot of greenhouses use, is to use a shade barrier cloth. This shade barrier cloth is kind of a loose woven nylon, and it can cut the shade whatever percentage you want. What I have here, it cuts about 25% of the sunlight, and it shades the plants, keeping them cool. Because even though our daytime temperatures are still pretty high, in the shade, it hasn't warmed up that much. And that'll be perfect for these crops, giving them the warmth they need to grow, but not the heat that it'll take to make them bolt. Putting a shade barrier over this is pretty simple. What you want to do is make sure you put this cloth in between the plant and the path of the sun, taking especial care to make sure that that hot afternoon sun is what you're going after to block the most. For this, a simple lean-to is what we're going to use. So we're going to take more pea fencing, and we're going to take it and lean it against our fence so that the peas still have plenty of room to grow. And then we're going to take a couple of different bolts of this cloth, open it up, and lay it down. It's as simple as that. All you have to do then is just clip it onto the fence itself to keep it from blowing to Kansas, and you're in good shape. So we're going to take that. We're going to run these down the line, making sure we overlap just a little bit so that these peas stay nice and cool underneath. And that's one thing that you can do. This is readily available at a lot of different garden centers, but you may have to ask for them to specially order it for you if you can't find it locally. Call around and they'll be able to hook you up with some. The next thing you want to think about when setting up your garden, especially if you've already got your warm season seedlings in, but you haven't had a chance to set up your irrigation, now is the time to start considering putting in something that is for drip irrigation rather than overhead sprinklers. Although overhead sprinklers do the job, it can cause a little bit of problem both with evaporation, so you're losing a lot of our precious water to the atmosphere, but it can also start spreading disease. A better choice is to go with soaker hoses or drip emitters. In this case, in this garden, they put down the soaker hoses that run the length of the garden. This is basically like a leaky pipe. It's very porous material, and as you can see here, the water just seeps out on either side of it, gently flowing into the soil over a period of time so that the plant is given water right at the roots. Keeping the roots hydrated and cool are two things that we can do to make sure even our warm season vegetables are going to be able to survive such scalding heat that we have now. When they're young, they don't have a huge root system to take up all the water that they need to stay cool. They're at risk of burning out right now, this week, with this kind of heat. So get your irrigation lines down. And the second thing and most critical component is to mulch them in. So you have your hoses down. Then you want to take just standard newspaper. You want to keep it from the glossy pages, so you want to use just the rag pages. And lay them down 2 sheets thick. This is going to help prevent weeds from coming up and keep the ground nice and cool. So once you've got this down, overlapping the pages just a little bit, take some soft mulch. I'm using straw here, but you can use grass clippings or any other type of soft mulch. And you want to take it and lay it down about 3 to 4 inches thick. So as you go through, you're weighing down your newspaper with this mulch and tucking your plants in. This will keep them from getting too hot and too dry, especially if you have to water them and go to work, or if you're having you out of town for just a couple of days. This will help keep them cool, and it'll help keep your garden in production. Once you've got your irrigation lines down and mulched in, the last stage that you're going to do is to make sure that you don't overwater the garden, which would be just as killer as hot weather. Invest in a couple of nice water timers if you don't have a system that you can plumb right into your sprinkler system at the house. These hose end timers will do wonders for letting you have the freedom to set your irrigation to come on and shut off, and you don't have to be there to do it. I'm Carol O'Mara, and I'm helping you to garden.
Radio EcoShock.
So let's get to Florida, where it's hot, 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 and humid, too. Sumter County Extension agent Brooke Moffis tells us how we can keep ourselves safe from heat stroke while keeping summer plants alive.
With me is Brooke Moffis to talk about how to beat the heat of summer gardening. Welcome, Brooke.
Hi, thanks for having me today, Julie.
Well, I was out yesterday working in the heat in our garden, so tell me, what are some ways, what I should have been doing to keep myself safe while working in my garden this summer?
Okay, one thing you want to do is slow down when you're working in the garden in the summer months.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you want to do your strenuous activity in the morning or the mm-hmm. late evenings. I know it sounds like common sense, but you want to avoid the middle of the day whenever possible. Other things you can do is dress for the summer. Wear lightweight clothing, wear hats like this,
the broad,
with a wide
with
brim. Yeah, I actually have one that's much wider than this, and it's not quite so pretty. But anyway, that's the one that I wear outside the garden. But, you know, of course, the bigger the brim, the more it's going to protect your face, your shoulders, your neck, that type of thing.
And that one's got, it's kind of woven so you can get some air,
exactly,
some air flowing through your hat.
That's important with your clothes, too. You want to wear lightweight clothes and light-colored clothes.
Mm-hmm.
It can be very tempting when you're working outside to work in jeans, but try to get something that's, you know, a little bit lighter fabric. One thing I like to wear is those fishing shirts.
Oh, those nylon ones that are
that
real
have,
lightweight?
That have, like, the
yes.
vent in the back. That allows a little bit of airflow. So that's another thing you can do is dress for the heat. Make sure you don't get too much sun. Don't go to the beach the day before and get sunburned and then go work out in your yard, because your body, when it's sunburned, can't cool itself.
Mm-hmm.
So another thing that you can do, too, is to not eat a lot of protein, because protein can actually make your body produce more heat. So that's something a lot of people wouldn't have thought of. You know, so don't eat a meal with eggs and bacon and then go outside at 11 a.m. and work out in your garden. Again, I know it sounds like common sense, but it's still hard.
Or even,
you know,
just a big meal, especially with protein, but even just a big meal, too.
Right. You also want to avoid alcoholic drinks, too. You know, if it's a Saturday afternoon and that beer sounds really, really good in your
while
fridge.
While you're mowing the grass?
Yeah,
no.
Exactly. No, not a good idea. Drink water instead and have your beer later that day. Also, if you're taking salt tablets, don't take them if you're going to be working outside, unless a physician has told you that you need to be taking salt mm-hmm. tablets. But that's another thing to be concerned with, too.
Well, you said that you had symptoms of heat exhaustion one time. I know I get a headache afterwards when I've been really hot. What are some of the main symptoms of heat exhaustion?
Well, headache is one of the first symptoms. Dizziness, fainting, that can occur as well. Also, heavy sweating, especially if you feel cold and clammy.
Mm-hmm.
That's another sign that you're suffering from heat exhaustion. You can get very irritable and you can get confused. So
I get irritable when I get hot anyway.
Yeah, exactly. Weakness, vomiting, that can happen. A weak pulse can be another mm-hmm. symptom. And another thing is, with heat exhaustion, your body temperature doesn't necessarily get hot. So if you're actually to take a thermometer and take that person's temperature, mm-hmm. their body temperature may not actually increase. I know that sounds strange, but that's different with a heat stroke.
Okay, and when heat stroke, you actually stop sweating.
Right. Heat stroke, you get dry, hot skin, and you don't sweat. As soon as that happens, you need to get out of the sun. You can also, you know, have confusion with that one, too. You can get a rapid, strong pulse, and your body temperature will go up drastically.
Right. So what are some ways that we can, besides taking care of ourselves, what are some ways that we can maintain our garden? While we're taking care of ourselves, how can we take care of our plants when it's so hot?
Well, when it's this hot, one thing that you can do is follow the shade around your yard. So,
good point.
You know, work on one side of your house that's shaded in the morning, and then as the day goes on, go around to the other side of the house and work there where it's shaded. Another thing you can do is have a shade garden, too. So great way to, you know, get out of the heat but still garden. Some plants that you can grow are caladiums, you know, a lot of tropical plants you can grow in the shade, bromeliads too. And I love these shade plants because they provide a lot of color in the landscape.
Yeah, caladiums are great. When it's really hot, I mean, I know some things you can grow in Florida all year long and some you can't. What are some plants that we can grow in the summer when it's so hot?
Okay, one thing is portulaca. That one is very heat tolerant.
Mm-hmm.
It's very tolerant of dry conditions. Salvias are great, too, and salvias come in all different sizes, all different colors. You know, you see the small red one that everyone thinks of as a bedding plant. That one can get maybe 6 inches tall.
So how can we figure out which other plants? Is there some place, like a website I can go to look for plants that can take the heat?
You know, one of the best things to do is to visit your local county extension office, you know, Sumter County for me, mm-hmm. Lake County for you. And, you know, those residents can attend gardening classes there or even speak to master gardeners in the plant clinic to see what plants they should grow in heat, you know, heat conditions. There's also something out there called like a heat index map, or I guess you could say a heat zone map. And it came out in the early 90s. And, you know, you remember the hardiness zone map?
Yeah, I was going to say, so they're different.
Right. The hardiness zone is the lowest temperature that plant can take. That's great if you want to see if a plant can survive a freeze in the area. The heat one is the opposite. Can it tolerate the amounts of heat? The only thing is this hasn't really been in a lot of publications yet. So as time goes on, we'll have a heat index where people can see the coldest temperature a plant can take and they can see the hottest temperature a plant can take.
Where would somebody go to find that?
You can actually go online. American Horticulture Society is the one that put that heat index map out.
Okay. So we've got our plants. We've got the right plants chosen. Do we need to fertilize them as much or less during the summer?
If a plant is actively growing and it's getting enough water, you should fertilize during the summer months. As a general rule, you want to fertilize in March, July, September with a slow-release fertilizer. If we're in a drought situation and those plants are really stressed out, especially turf grass, you may want to refrain from fertilizing. Because that, when you fertilize, it's, you know, telling that plant to, or it's giving that plant the nutrients it needs to push out new growth. And a plant that's drought stressed, you know, maybe can't cope with all that growth.
And speaking of water, since it doesn't seem like it's ever going to rain much.
I know. We might be in for it this year. Mm-hmm.
How often should people be watering their landscape plants?
Best thing to do is get a rain gauge, especially during the summer months. You know, we get those afternoon thunderstorms and showers. So you just want to make sure that you're getting at least an inch a week, if possible. Another thing that you can do is look for indicator plants. Azaleas are one of the first plants to wilt when we have a drought. So if you have an azalea in your yard, when that thing starts wilting, it's a good idea to get out there and water your landscape.
And you can get a rain gauge at your local hardware store, garden center, you know.
Right, that's correct.
Okay.
And they can range in price. You can get a really pretty one for $20-$30. You can get a real cheap one for a couple bucks.
We got the cheap plastic one.
Me too.
So one last question about vegetables. What kind of vegetables can we plant this time of year?
Okay, well, we typically do vegetable gardens in the cooler months in Florida. We do it over the fall, do it through the spring. But you can get by with some vegetables in the summer. Cherry tomatoes is one. You want to look for cultivars like Heat Wave and Tropic if you can find those. Eggplant you can grow through the summer. Sweet potatoes. And some peas you can grow through the summer, too.
Okra you can grow in the summer, too,
Oh,
right?
Yes. Okra is great to grow in the summer, yes.
So, okay. And any other problems that you might want to tell us about?
Disease and insects can be a problem in the summer months, especially if we are getting frequent afternoon showers. Insects and disease love hot temperatures. They love humidity. So it's a good idea to get out there into your landscape, scout the landscape. Do you ever just piddle in your yard where you go out there and you've worked out there for an hour, but it looks like you haven't done anything?
Yes.
Well, I do that sometimes, too. But that's a great time to actually monitor those plant leaves. If you see any spots, if you see any insect pests, pick those leaves off, stick them in a baggie, and take them to your county extension office. We can tell you how to treat it if you don't know.
Great. Well, thank you, Brooke. That's been a lot of great hints to help us beat the heat. Thank you.
My thanks to the University of Florida for that audio. Find links to the video in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.info. This has been Radio EcoShock. Don't miss our SoundCloud page. And all the links in the blog at ecoshock.info. The theme song this week was 96 Degrees in the Shade by the band Third World. I'm Alex Smith. Thank you for listening and caring about your world.